You are Locked On Timberwolves, your daily podcast on the Minnesota Timberwolves, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, to another Locked On Wolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I am your host, Colt Molesky. You can find all of my other work at zonecoverage.com or follow me on Twitter at cmolesky. If you choose to do so and let me know how the show is going, let me know what you think, what you'd like to see on the show. Joining me is Dane Moore. Dane, this is one of those, I try to pride myself on having a really well-planned out show, or at least a fairly well-planned out show, and knowing what I'm going to talk about, but this is just one of those days where there's just plenty of topics to touch on and tons to talk about.
Let's get into it. Things are going well.
Things are going well for the Timberwolves. I would like to get your take on the Cavs, just because I feel like everybody has one, and it's just a fascinating storyline. Whoever says regular season NBA is boring does not pay attention to the regular season NBA, because this is this has been just a fun year and great storylines throughout the entirety of it. But first of all, 126-118, 2-2 without Butler, the Wolves take on the Clippers and beat them on the road, starting out the West Coast road trip right with a big W over the Clippers. We're going to get into how the game finished, because it was pretty fun to watch the end of this game as well. But overall, 40 points for Wiggins, 30 from Teague. He had 6 assists as well. You had the double-double, 11-17 from Towns. Bielitsa dropped 18 points. Great game from the Timberwolves.
It was. Yeah, I think you look at these last two games with Butler and Crawford out, and that would immediately inspire fear for a team that lacks wing depth. I think when you went into that Raptors game and deleting Butler and Crawford, you don't really know what's going to happen on the wing. With Bielitsa, you figure he's going to get the start, and then Nino Marcus-Georges-Hunt will play some. And then it's kind of a big question mark of, how do they round out the rest of the minutes? And sure enough, Shabazz Muhammad has been back in the rotation and playing a little bit, contributing. He's the same character, but it has worked. And I think this is such an interesting juxtaposition and kind of a sign of the growth from this earlier in the season, when the Wolves were without Jimmy Butler also for two games and got just shellacked against Indiana and Detroit, and now you have these two games without Butler, and the team has been able to not only exist, but kind of thrive without Butler as well. And I think that is just a huge testament to the growth. Andrew Wiggins obviously has played a big role in the past two games, but I have one idea that I'm kind of working on, looking at the two of those, and to the two different times Butler was out. And my question is on Jamal Crawford. Is Jamal Crawford not playing actually helping this Timberwolves team? Because as great as his handles are and is the nicest guy in the locker room, I can't take anything away from him there. But according to ESPN's defensive RPM numbers, he's the worst defensive shooting guard in the NBA, so of course it hurts to lose Butler on the wing, but maybe deleting Crawford's minutes and replacing them with more Wiggins, a defensive-minded Georges-Hunt, maybe that's what's helping this team as well. What do you think there?
That's a really interesting take. I've had a lot of conversations with people over the weekend about Wiggins' deal and how it looks like maybe they jumped on Wiggins too early, because you can't get Max Wiggins without or with Butler on the roster, which I'll get into later. But that is a really interesting take, that the defensive negative of Crawford is hurting this team far more than his offensive positive. Again, another night with Marcus-Georges-Hunt on the floor. I really like watching him play defense, and I'm going to be honest with the people, because I try to be an honest guy. I did not watch the game last night. I took the wife out, and I treated her to a movie night and a nice wine and popcorn and a movie. But this morning I was watching the game, and the defense looks very smooth. And it kind of, going back to your point about Crawford, there's not when Marcus George's Hunt is out there and you have Wiggins playing up-tempo or better on defense, you have Towns playing better on defense, the defensive side looks smooth. And I just think that there's a level of maturity with these guys, even if you're taking out or putting in Crawford, with Wiggins and Towns now, that you just didn't see in the first couple games that Butler was out. And I think you might be onto something there. Crawford is a big negative on the defensive side, and I don't think you really notice it because you're so taken with the crossover and with the threes that he hits until he's actually out.
Yeah, I just think it's been illustrative of that. I mean, it's defense is often something that doesn't necessarily jump out to you that someone is a bad defender. Obviously, that kind of has happened with Towns when he was struggling at the beginning of the year, but oftentimes, figuring out how good or bad someone is at defense really requires some digging, or something like this where an example of the contrapositive is shown. And I think we're seeing that with Crawford some too. Also, he has a nearly 20-year career that suggests, at least statistically, that he's not just a bad defender, he's been awful. So this is by no means me calling for Jamal Crawford to be out of the rotation, but it's interesting and maybe a sign that there's been a little bit of an overall reliance on him early on this season, and that he's kind of a major piece of this team when in fact he's just a role player. He's a bench role player that can microwave your team on offense, and you hope that the defense doesn't get exploited. But maybe as the season rolls on, and as once you have an eye on the playoffs and playoff series where weaknesses are exploited, I think the team needs to learn how to be able to survive a game where Jamal Crawford only plays 8 minutes, even when he's healthy, because if it's 18 minutes, he's going to probably get taken advantage of.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And the other thing that stuck out to me in this game outside of Wiggins, which I want to get to in a little bit here, Teague looked really good. He looked really crisp on offense. I like Teague a lot, and I think he's a pretty solid. I would say he's a top 15, top 17 point guard. Probably he's just a fringe, like right there at 15, 16 in the NBA, just because he can have such good nights like tonight, or like the other night, excuse me. But I really feel like he's one of those guys where you really kind of know what kind of game he's going to have in the first like 15 minutes. And that was, he and Wiggins looked really good in transition. He wasn't making any really mental errors. He was shooting really well. He's just one of those guys where I think you kind of feel it in that first 12 to 15 minutes if he's going to have a big night.
Well, it's the example of when more opportunity is there, kind of, or having things be illuminated by the fact of someone else not being there. And I think that's kind of what we've seen with Teague too, is then with no Butler, there's more of a need for offensive assertion, and Jeff Teague jumped on that, as did Andrew Wiggins, of course. But also in these two games, it's interesting too that Karl Towns didn't shoot a shot in the entire first half of he didn't shoot a shot in the entire first half of the Raptors game. He played great in the second half, and then he didn't make a shot till the end of the fourth quarter of this game against the Clippers. So he guys kind of had a couple off nights and foul trouble and such, but it is very positive, of course, to see Wiggins and Teague be able to recognize, okay, Butler's not here, okay, Towns isn't going, it's on me to kind of make things happen. And to kind of transition to Wiggins a little bit here is, I think a weakness of his and just kind of a problem with his effectiveness over the first 3 years is it was so often that he had in his head, okay, if I don't score here, the team's going to lose. There's no other options. And so this has been enlightening to the fact that it's that same mentality. The team needs Wiggins, and he's actually doing something with it, and he's playing well with it and not struggling and not, taking bad shots or not getting the most out of it. Because I think a lot of the time when he got in that mentality, his first couple years in the league, it was like, okay, I'm going to rely on what I know how to do best, like cross, 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 spin, fadeaway, jump shot. And now when the ball is in his hands, he's doing a better job of discerning what the best option was. I think the fourth quarter he fell off a little bit, but largely in these two games without Butler, obviously Wiggins' stat line speaks for itself and how impressive he's been.
Mm-hmm. There was an interesting kind of take pitch to me over the weekend and last night especially, but over the weekend as well, that I want to run past you. But first, we're going to have a quick word from our sponsors. Here's what some people were telling me after you see Wiggins really have great games with Butler out. And now, this is not my take. The people who brought this take to me shall remain nameless, but it is something that I feel like is in the minds of at least a few Timberwolves fans, where there was concern that if you don't get rid of Wiggins by the trade deadline, then you've signed a guy to a max deal who is at his best when your star player's off the floor. Now, I don't agree with this, but I have a take on this as well, but what would you say to fans who think that you're not getting the best value for Wiggins under his max contract if he's on the same team as Butler, and so you should trade him because of that?
Well, let's look at the teams that have good players. They also have multiple good players. Oftentimes, a good player makes the second best player better. Let's go down the list here. Golden State, Houston, Boston. I mean, the good teams have multiple good options. I mean, I don't know if we're still somewhat caught in the illusion of the idea that Andrew Wiggins is ready to be a number one option on a winning team. I mean, you can talk about potential as much as you want, but as Andrew Wiggins stands now, he's nowhere near being a number one option on a playoff team. I mean, very, very few players inherently are that. So I don't get that and the idea that we're even entertaining the conversation of a Wiggins trade at the deadline is silly. That's just not going to happen. I don't think the team's even going to make a trade. And if they do, we're not at the Andrew Wiggins point because if you were to trade Andrew Wiggins is the type of player who gets moved for a bigger, better player. Like, say the Portland Trailblazers just want to kind of their experiment doesn't work in 2 years and they want to move CJ McCollum. The type of player CJ McCollum gets moved for is Andrew Wiggins. Or if we want to get a bigger, even bigger, crazier name, I mean, Anthony Davis. If that ends up being blown up, the centerpiece of what the Pelicans would want to be taking back is a young player that still has an untapped ceiling. And why I say that would need to be down the road is because Andrew Wiggins is making $7 million a year right now. And once he makes his max, it'd be $25 million. It'd be just a lot more difficult to maneuver trading him right now. And actually, I just kind of think that's a silly conversation. It's not happening at the trade deadline.
Here's the problem I think a lot of people run into. And I don't want to see Wiggins leave either. And you're absolutely right. Good teams have a lot of good players. They don't have one star player and then a bunch of B guys. You have to have a couple A players on the same roster. Here's the thing I think people constantly get hung up on is the max money. And that's just something you had to do because, let's face it, another team was going to pay Wiggins a lot of money if the Timberwolves didn't. 100%.
Don't get me wrong. That contract might sink this Timberwolves boat. And when 2 years down the road, and if Andrew Wiggins is still anything similar to what he is today, and Carl Anthony Towns has signed a $190 million contract, and Jimmy Butler has signed a $190 million contract, and then you're at the point where you can't do anything, you have no flexibility to do anything around Butler, Wiggins, and Towns, and Butler, Wiggins, and Towns are still just what they are right now. I mean, that Wiggins contract could completely sink them because right now he's nowhere near. His marginal productivity is nowhere near his dollar value of
yes, but
what's coming
but in up. Over this period, you kind of had to do that. That's kind of the risk. It's a little bit of a risk, but you had to do it. I think.
No, it's a risk reward calculation because there is the possibility that Andrew Wiggins becomes something great, and what were they going to do? They couldn't just not sign him and let him walk. The option would have been was to use this year as a test drive, not give him the extension, and then reapproach the conversation talks at the end of this season. That would have been fine because it's an extension. It has not yet started this year. How rookie extensions work is it will kick in the following season. So The point is they didn't have to sign him to a max extension last summer. That's why I didn't want them to do that, because everything of Andrew Wiggins' first 3 years in the NBA, 240 games, suggested that Andrew Wiggins, what he is on the floor, is nowhere near a maximum caliber player. So take another year. Maybe he develops. Maybe Jimmy Butler leads him along the way. And then you would have had a better idea if this is something you wanted to lock into for the future. But they opted to give him the contract extension to keep him and his people happy and engaged. And I guess they must have viewed it that it was a lock that they were going to give it to him the next year no matter what. But I think you see a lot of teams that maybe would have used a little more patience in discerning that. I mean, obviously Zach LaVine tore his ACL, but he wasn't signed to an extension. There's a lot of good players who get through their third year and do not sign contract extensions. The mistake if Timberwolves made one was not giving the money. It's when they gave the money. They could have done it in another year.
Yeah, and there could have been some patience there. Nevertheless, it was a little bit of a risk. But you can't trade Wiggins, because even if he's not offensively as good with Butler out there, he's still a great defensive asset. And I feel like, don't you want a guy who you know could have a 40-point game, like in a game 6 against like the Thunder or something like that? Like, don't you want a guy who you know can pull out a big game when the spotlight's really bright and when they need offense? You know, you got to have a few of those guys that can have a monster game on your roster, even if they aren't having that monster game every other night in the regular season because they have a lot of talent on their roster. Like, it's silly to be worried about overpaying a guy in the future because he's having good games while other players are out right now.
So here's my thing, and I was thinking about this last night, is we look at the games that Wiggins has blown up over the course of his career. Five times last season he had over 40 points in a game. At no point, or only one of those games, did another player ever score 25 or more points also in that same game. And so my question becomes is can Andrew Wiggins have a blow-up explosive game, as he did and has shown he definitely has the ability to do, but can he do that while another player also goes off in the same game? And I think that is what the key is. And my biggest issue with this team's offense as a whole is it still feels like baton passing. Carl, your turn. Jimmy, your turn. Jimmy, probably your turn again. Andrew, your turn. It's not, there isn't the cohesion you see with the other best offenses in the NBA that let the game dictate who's getting the shot. It seems that Carl only got one shot in the third quarter. We got to make sure we feed him in the fourth. Like that's not how the best teams operate. They let the offense in and they let the game dictate. So my concern with Andrew Wiggins, to your point, is that for him to be great, others often aren't great around him.
That's true, but at the same, and maybe this is just a little bit of a cop-out response, and this is kind of the theme of this team so far, is kind of wait it out and let's see how they develop. But at the same time, we had huge question marks early in the season about the defense and the defensive development and where are these young guys, are they going to grow? And now the defense has kind of come along for the Timberwolves. I think maybe Andrew Wiggins is just one of those guys where everybody else needs to be kind of in the can for him to have a really big night, and maybe that's just the way it is for him. But for the rest of the offense, I really feel like in the next couple of months you'll see some of that offensive gelling where it doesn't have to be a passing of the baton. And all right, now it's Butler. It's the fourth quarter, so Butler's going to take all the shots and be the offensive guy. I think that you're going to see them move on from that, and they've just got to get more time on the court together. And I know that it's kind of a cop-out answer.
I hope so. Yeah, and I certainly think it's possible. I'm just saying we haven't seen that pretty much ever in Andrew Wiggins' career. Like, just take a second right now and think about a game in which you can ever think of that it was Towns and Wiggins simultaneously were having massive nights. It doesn't happen. It's one or the other, and that's rewinding back to the two previous seasons. But again, to your point, if that does happen, this team's ceiling bumps up all the higher. And maybe
it doesn't happen for Wiggins, but I'm saying if you can get Teague, Towns, and Butler to be on the same page where it doesn't feel like that much of a passing of a baton between those three guys. And then you have a guy like Wiggins who, when all those guys are having bad nights, can come in and have a 40-point night. That's still a better ceiling than right now, even. And this ceiling right now is pretty good.
Yeah, okay, but if those other guys are all sucking and Andrew Wiggins gets 40 points, they're losing a playoff game. Right? They're not winning a playoff game.
Probably. Well, I guess that depends on your definition of sucking, because Towns had a pretty down night, and he still had 11-17. His play on the boards was solid. All these guys can help a team in other ways outside of scoring, too, is the thing. So if Butler has a bad night, that might be 14 points, but I still think he gets some rebounds and some assists and has a bunch of steals.
Fair.
So I think Teague too. Teague, if he has a bad night, the other night against the Raptors, he still had 10 assists. If this team has those three guys not scoring the ball very well, I think then it's a slugfest, and they make it where Wiggins has a real shot to maybe win the game if he has a 40-point game. It's kind of the way these guys play.
Defining them having a good game simply by their point total is not the way to do it, particularly with four players who all can score in bunches, and there's only one basketball, as the saying goes. So that is totally fair. And to the Teague point, and I don't even think we've shined enough light on this, and I talked about earlier how in Wiggins' other 40-point games, there oftentimes wasn't another player who played well alongside him or scored in volume alongside him. And Jeff Teague did do that last night. So
yep.
There's certainly some optimism in the way of that Jeff Teague played well alongside Andrew Wiggins. And let's remember this from Jeff Teague too, that he's has shown that top 15 point guard ability that you talked about at the beginning of the episode.
For sure. Before we head to our next break, and just to wrap that all up, Dane and I definitely don't think they should be talking about trading Wiggins. That's silliness from a few fans, and hopefully that's not a narrative that kind of develops over the next week or so. But the other two things that stuck out to me was this is the second game in a row where a star for the other team had a big night. You had Blake Griffin with the triple-double, 32-12-12, and it didn't phase the team that much. And they got to the free throw line a lot, which I think is something that Butler has instilled in a lot of these guys. They almost doubled up the free throws from the night before on Toronto, and they almost did it again against the Clippers. They had 39 attempts to the Clippers' 22 attempts. Great job. And they had a pretty close, if you don't have Blake Griffin with the double dribble at the end there in the last minute, this game is a very close game, an even tighter game. And so they kind of escape because they had the discipline to get to the line a bunch earlier in the game, and that really paid out throughout the game.
Right. I would have been that would have been a nightmare if they would have ended up choking at the end there, because what preceded the Blake Griffin double dribble was a completely lost his focus for a minute play where the ball was inbounded to Karl Anthony Towns, and he immediately turned the ball over and just too out of bounds, and that made no sense. And so I just feel like that would have been like twisting the dagger of what was probably Towns' worst game of the season. That would have been an interesting rebound project for how he would have reacted to that, because Tibbs was not happy with Carl.
That said, though, the defense to put Blake in that position where he had to try and come back from the other side of the court was a really nice rebound. Usually you see the Timberwolves, after a lapse on the offensive side, they have a lapse to pair with it on the defensive side, at least earlier in the season you did. But to have them come back and really play tight and force them to the other side of the court was a nice play.
You know, and these were two tough games for Karl Anthony Towns, largely, or there was chunks of the games that were tough. But I think they also just show the fact that he isn't really the type of player who gets discouraged and mentally removes himself from the game. And he didn't take a shot in the first half of that Raptors game and immediately came out and asserted his offensive dominance, scoring 22 points, only missing one shot in the second half. He doesn't really disappear for extended periods of time. And he can come back in, he can have a short memory, as you said, to the defense on Griffin. What made me start thinking about this was after Griffin turned that ball over, Towns was fouled, and he's at the free throw line. shooting big free throws, and he just kind of, he looked like a grown-up, and he got to the line, like, took some deep breaths, and he actually missed the second free throw, but he knocked down the first one, and I to me, it just spoke to the idea that, that Towns is, he's not an easily phased person, and
he's a professional.
Short memory or whatever. Yeah, and that's impressive at 22 years old. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think so. And one thing I wanted to loop back to also, you pointed out Lowry and Griffin both going off. And just as like a more broader generalizing statement, I think it takes more than one really good performance to beat this Timberwolves team now.
Yeah.
There wasn't really much else around Kyle Lowry in that game. DeRozan definitely had a quiet night. And then while Lou Williams sparked up here and there with the Clippers, it was mostly Blake Griffin last night. Montrezl Harrell did some stuff in the first half, but
I called him having a good game, by the way, just
right.
to say.
Well, that's a whole other thing. Is that type of player, kills the Wolves. And I mean, mm-hmm. go to Bismack Biyombo a week ago. It's that strong, physical athlete center that can just wreak havoc on the boards and
run the floor.
Run the floor when the Wolves pick and roll defense breaks down. He's there to get easy dunks, and so yeah, I'm concerned about that type of player in a playoff matchup. I think you and I have probably talked about this before. I have concerns about Steven Adams in a 7-game series and the Wolves ever being able to physically slow him.
I just thought that it was really good for the Timberwolves to see them stare down a guy like Blake Griffin or Kyle Lowry having a big night and say, that's fine. You can have those shots, but we're not going to let anybody else really start feeling it. And that was especially noted when you're playing a guy like Lou Williams, who has been averaging in January 30 points per game, 31.7 points per game, something like that. So I thought that was a really good performance from the Timberwolves. We're going to take one more break, and then we're going to discuss the Cavaliers. I got to get your take on this, because this is a fascinating story to me, just because the Cavaliers, they've lost, I think 9 of their last 12. They are, again, having all these problems. You just had the report that they had the team meeting where players were questioning the legitimacy of the illness that Kevin Love was experiencing to go out early against OKC. It's kind of a mess again, like they started out the year for the Cavaliers, and their cap situation is a mess, so they can't really go out and get a big-name player without going deep into the luxury this year or next year. And so they'd have to pick up some role players if they want to get any better, and those guys are going to be either really good on defense or really good on offense, but they're not going to help the team in a two-way sense. It's a mess. I want to get your two-minute take on the Cavaliers, Dane.
I just think, out of desperation, they're just gonna go for it, and they're gonna trade the Brooklyn pick for something, and they're just gonna cobble it all together to try and put together the best possible team they can this year. We were talking about it on Wolves Wired, the other podcast I do, and you look at the end of the Cavs era before he went to Miami. That's what they did that last trade deadline too. They went out.
You're absolutely right.
Wallace, Wally Zerbiak, Joe. I mean they're gonna do the 2018 version of that, and we'll see what that Brooklyn pick can render. I think it might be able to get a really nice piece back, just because I don't think a lot of people are gonna be active on this market. I mean, I wouldn't rule out them doing something with that. And
is there like a Kemba Walker for the Brooklyn pick and Isaiah Thomas and like Amon Shumpert or something? Is that like a trade they could feasibly pull off?
You know, Kemba is the one that I don't really see happening, because I don't think you can play him off ball. And mm-hmm. I think that's mm-hmm. why George Hill, and this is what I'm talking about, maybe not with the Brooklyn pick move, but as a secondary move on top of the Brooklyn move, would be going to get like a George Hill. And then you can play George Hill alongside Isaiah Thomas. And that would work better. I just don't see how they get Kemba without trading Isaiah Thomas, and I don't see them trading Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah.
But I maybe that would just be really sad for Thomas
to be bumping around. The thing with George Hill is he's set to make, what is it, I think $19.5 million?
Yeah.
And then you pair that with like the Tristan Thompson contract, the Kyle Korver contract isn't exactly great for them. And then you still have, and the biggest thing, the real question mark really is LeBron James, because either you're tearing apart your franchise's future for a guy that's not staying, or he is staying, and you have to win it now because
that's why they're just going to let him be the GM. Just let him be the GM. Hey, do whatever. What do you want? What do you want? We'll do it if this means that you're staying. And so if he can go pick and choose his pieces that he wants, and hopefully they can give him some guidance. It's not as if the Cavs don't have the pieces. Maybe they just are willing to eat as much luxury tax dirt as is needed. I mean, to the point with the George Hill thing, they would need to be sending out money to go away with him too, which mm-hmm. would be J.R. Smith or Tristan Thompson. And so that actually would have, like, George Hill doesn't make that much more than either of those guys.
You have to get rid of the Tristan Thompson contract somehow.
If I were them, I'd rather get rid of JR. I think
that's true. Either way, both those are really bad contracts.
Yeah. JR, and this is, I don't know where I read this, but apparently JR Smith's daughter's, like, really sick this year. Like,
yeah, she has that. I think it's the heart condition that she was born with, and they've always that's always been kind of a thing that they've had to fight through.
Yeah, and I think maybe don't quote me on this, but maybe it's like gotten worse, and some people have pointed to that just really being because J.R. Smith is having a way worse year. I mean, just he seems to be much disconnected, and we sometimes forget the personal element of these games. I remember Nicholas Batum a couple years back, he had a god-awful season, and then when he signed a big contract, people were all concerned, but he went on to say that he had a really difficult personal year there. He went through a super messy divorce with his mm-hmm. wife, and like that affected his play. So not to totally rip on J.R. Smith if he has his personal things going on, but they need a different J.R. Smith. They need something else on the wing, and Schumpert's not that, so I don't know if it's George Hill or something else that presents itself becomes made possible. I would look at Kidd Gilchrist if I were them. I mean, you got plenty of shooting on that team. Kidd Gilchrist is the Jay Crowder you thought you were getting as a defensive stopper. I mean, he is a legitimate wing defender. I mean, that's a commitment to the future because Kidd Gilchrist has three more years left on his contract, but I think they can make moves if they just go fantasy basketball mode and let it rip. I just assume that's what's going to happen because they're screwed if LeBron leaves.
They really are. I was thinking Kent Bazemore might be another one. Where
another impactful but expensive.
He is expensive, but at the same time, he's like a better version of the 3-and-D that J.R. Smith is right now. He's like J.R. Smith 4 years ago, except I think he may have a little bit better of a drive to the basket. I don't know. Just they really, honestly, when I'm looking at guys, either you need like an all-star level player to swing the needle, or you just need two like really solid defenders who can sometimes do offensive stuff.
Yeah, and I think that could be Kent Bazemore. And I think mm-hmm. as time kind of trickles on more towards the deadline, more of these names, like as Kemba Walker's has spilled out, as George Hill's has spilled out, become at least potentially available, and the Cavs can get in the mix there. And what I really do think is an interesting piece is I don't see this being a super active trade deadline, and then as it goes, with less demand equals a lower price. So the Cavs really might be able to get a lot out of that Brooklyn pick and what they have simply from having the highest appetite for buying.
You don't think it's going to be... I think this trade deadline is going to be crazy. I think it's going to mirror a little bit of the summer and just be crazy.
I think we hope for that, but I mean, the guys who are in the weeds with that are assuming, like the actual reporters, the Mark Steins and such, are reporting that it's going to be quiet. And the reason, and there's actually like an anecdotal reason for that, is that there's very few expiring contracts out there to be moved. Those are often key in making moves happen, and it's just how the salaries happen to be shaken out this year. There's just not a lot of guys on expiring deals that can facilitate moves.
No.
And the Golden State Warriors are here. Like, why try and get better? Like, I mean, I want the Wolves to maybe improve on the margins if they can, but would I want to, like, try and sacrifice the future to add a big piece just for this year so the Wolves can try and compete with the Rockets and the Warriors? No, that would be not a good idea. That would, mortgaging the future to compete with the Warriors would be silly in this season.
That's true.
Have the longest view in the room.
That's true, but at the same time, the Cavs are a team in the East. And so right now, mortgaging your future, or even if you're not the Cavs, if you're like Washington, giving up some of your future to get to the finals might be something I would at least think about. Like, maybe you're not going to beat the Warriors, but you could still go to the finals. Like, if you're the Timberwolves, unless Curry and Durant and Klay roll their ankles tomorrow, then you're not going to the finals. But the Wizards or a team like them could still make some moves to get to the finals at least. And that's why I think that the trade deadline could be interesting, because I think there's like four teams in the West, or not the West, the East, that want to make moves just to maybe make some waves in the playoffs.
Don't sleep on Toronto Raptors, man. If they can make something
Toronto's
happen.
Another one.
Toronto's bordering on my favorite for the NBA Finals. I think if I were to pick right now, it would be a toss up between Boston and Toronto as to who goes to the NBA Finals.
Gosh, I think Kyle Lowry. I would be fine with seeing him in the finals because I love Kyle Lowry.
And you know what? And people that kind of get the like noise. Like, oh, the Raptors in the finals, they would get their butts kicked by the Warriors. I don't think people have seen enough of this Toronto Raptors team. They defend and they shoot threes. They are a wildly effective offense. I mean, probably nobody's beating the Warriors. It doesn't matter.
You know why nobody talks about Toronto is because outside of DeRozan and Ibaka and Lowry, there's like every single night there's like two different guys that nobody knows who they are, but they have a huge night contributing in some way, and that's why. It's because they have like 10 B guys who just contribute night in and night out.
Put them on TNT once a month. That team gets no national acclaim at all. Like, just get the Lakers out of here. Let's watch the Toronto. Toronto like might go to the NBA Finals here. Maybe the national audience should have an idea of like who someone on that team is behind. Kyle Lowry. Like, they should be able to pronounce Valanciunas. It's silly. Like, that team's dang good. And for Wolves fans who maybe have the only games they've seen them play was against the Wolves, keep in mind they were on a road back-to-back after playing the San Antonio Spurs. The Raptors are a lot better than what that game was that the Wolves won. And be ready for Toronto when the Wolves are on a road back-to-back a week from now in Toronto.
That's going to be a very tough
rested.
Game.
That game's, I mean, almost as tough as the Golden State back-to-back that's coming up on Thursday. Toronto's no joke.
Those are almost two scheduled losses, it feels like. Almost.
I think they are.
I think if Butler's back, you have a shot at Toronto, but that's going to be so tough, especially if Lowry is hitting like he was the other night.
Yeah. A scheduled loss is, I mean, it's not a guarantee. That doesn't mean a 100%, but what factors could be worse? The Wolves are on a road back-to-back, flying to Toronto from Portland to go play on the road against one of the NBA's best teams. I mean, who's been resting at home? How do you get more schedule loss than that? Well, how you do it is this Thursday when the Wolves have to fly from Portland to Golden State to play.
I hate that so much.
Back to back. Yeah, no, it's a terrible. The Wolves can't get a true measuring stick game this year at all, because I guess that's just how the NBA season works with back to backs. Toronto was on a back to back. Cleveland was some sort of messed up whatever when they got to play them. Anthony Davis got ejected in the first quarter. It's like, it's crazy how few of the Wolves games you've seen both teams like at full strength just going up against each other. But
I was complaining
kind of how the regular season goes.
I was complaining to Mitch about this yesterday too. Is, can we not play in the Oracle maybe after back to backs? Can we not have the Warriors at home at the tail end of a road trip just once maybe this season? Come on, NBA scheduling.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other side of it is Wolves are probably going to lose that game no matter what. So take their schedule loss against the most likely team to beat them as is. I mean, I
no, I'm furious.
I'm furious. This could be a great game, but they always put it at like the end of a road trip, and it's like back to back, and the plane like crashes for the Timberwolves, and there's like fans booing them as they get into their locker room. It's just the worst possible scenario for the Timberwolves as they're playing the best team in the NBA. I think it's a little bit of BS. I'm going to say it.
No, that's fair. I mean, and that's why there's too many games in the season. That's what the issue is here. I mean, I'm gonna push back a little bit, and I don't think the Wolves are anywhere on Golden State's level. I think the Wolves are way up there, fourth or fifth best team maybe in the NBA. But Golden State is, to beat Golden State, Golden State would have to have an off night.
Well, I don't think they could beat them, but I think it could be a really good game if you have like the Timberwolves. At least they're rested, and if they're at home against the Warriors, I think that could be a great game. I don't think they win, but I think it could be a great game.
Okay, so here's a question, and obviously the teams would be rested for this. Say the Wolves get the 4 seed, they win in the first round. The Warriors get the first seed, they obviously win in the first round, and then the Warriors have home court advantage for the 7-game series in the second round. How does that series go?
Gentlemen's sweep.
Which is 5 games?
Yep. Gentlemen's sweep. I think the Wolves steal one at home.
Maybe.
There'll be
4.5 games.
It would be one at home where it's like a crazy game where both Butler and Wiggins and like Towns or Teague have really big games, and it's one of those where few games where Wiggins goes off with another player or two players, and Towns just totally like dominates against Draymond and Zaza and whoever else Jordan Bell is on the glass. It'd be one of those crazy games where they just every single Timberwolves player really gets up for the game.
Yeah, or the Warriors are as good as they were in the playoffs last year, and they won what, the first 15 games of the playoffs? Is that what happened?
Yeah, I don't know if I see this year. I think that there's a lot more talent spread out, and now obviously some injuries could happen going into the playoffs. But like they seem to happen every year for the Clippers. But if there's outside of a big injury, I just feel like there's a really good spread and mix of not only talent but of different kinds of styles of basketball spread amongst the teams right now in the playoff field for the West. And so I think that it's going to be way more impressive if the Warriors get to the finals flawless this year than it was the year before. Just because I feel like there's a lot of teams that maybe can't beat them, but that can give them a solid run for their money and at least win one or two games.
Right. Yeah, I hope so, man. I'm not just trying to be negative. I just think Golden State is a different monster and like an evolved different monster in the playoffs that they want to win series in 4 games.
Yeah.
To dominate and to save energy. So
their goal, I
think in a series against the Wolves, going more than 5 games, they would see almost as a failure in that sense, which is just mostly speaks to how ridiculous that team is. But
yeah. No, yeah. You're right.
Ridiculous.
It would be tough. We've been going an extremely long time, so I'm going to let the listeners go, but this has been a fun conversation. Definitely go check out all of the content after you're done listening to this on zonecoverage.com. There's lots of great podcasts as well as a ton of great articles from our superb staff of writers there on zonecoverage.com. Dane, thanks for coming on.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to another Locked On Wolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
You are Locked On Timberwolves, your daily Minnesota Timberwolves podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast.